Bly's future husband, Greg Withers, and his child friend, Greg Combe, were living through their own paternal tribulations and formed a lifelong bond in Sydney. They too would go on to have a big influence on Labor Party politics. Kevin Rudd was growing up fatherless. The trade union leader Bill Kelty had suffered similar tribulations. At a critical point in his adolescence, Mark Latham lost his father. Paternal loss was a bond that traversed Labor factions and gender politics. It became a point of personal determination for Bly that allowed, in a later time, her radicalism to be respected, softened, explained and understood. The interviews that emerged in the lead-up to her takeover as Premier from Peter Beattie were designed to give Bly that credibility. There is nothing like the truth to do that. But if you had suggested to the battered urban protesters of the late 70s and early 80s that one day hence, one of their own, a woman with strong feminist and left-wing political views, would be Premier of Queensland, they would have looked askance. After a few police hidings, most just wanted to get out of Queensland to the civilised calm of Sydney or Melbourne. Others were literally hounded out of the state. It's hard to describe the repressive atmosphere of Brisbane under the Bjelke-Petersen regime. Violence and anger were a disease that moved from the city streets into confrontations between people who should have been friends, into relationships, and into the very fabric of youth culture. Even Bly, who was the generation after those who took the real brunt of the Peterson police state years, had to get out for a while. After graduating from the University of Queensland, she moved to New Zealand and then to Sydney, where she met her future husband, Greg Withers. It would have been a hard decision to return, but led by the rather courageous Anne Warner, a group of women started to do things in what was to become Bly's future electorate of the West End. Bly also knew that there would be opportunities to come, and commendably, she went back into the fray in Brisbane. The turn of the tide came when arguably one of the most important change agents of the Australian 20th century, Tony Fitzgerald QC, became a head of the Royal Commission into Police Corruption in Queensland. It's only decades later that we really can assess the full significance of Fitzgerald. He exposed corruption from street level to the very top levels of government in Queensland. He set up a situation where successive Labor governments under Wayne Goss from 89 to 96 and Peter Beattie from 1998 to 2007 were able to fundamentally change the nature of Queensland's electoral laws, separation of powers, grassroots democracy, and much more. It's no accident that both Goss and Beattie were at their most impressive when they were implementing the Fitzgerald agenda. After the political and historical lag of the Bjelke-Petersen era, it was not hard to look good. Thank you. Elected in 1995, Anna Bligh did her political apprenticeship under Wayne Goss and Peter Beattie. These Labor governments enabled a group of more radical women to form around Anne Warner, who was a veteran of the Peterson years, the Brisbane street marches, and a bastion of women's politics. Elected to Parliament in 1983, Warner had been there and done that. Perhaps more than any other Labor politician of the time, she was prepared to take on Peterson and his cronies. Most importantly, she wanted to be a bridge for other women to come into Parliament, and Bligh benefited from seeing Warner battle it out with the National Party, but also, most importantly, with the men, pre-selection and power structures within the Queensland Labor Party. A tradition was being formed in which each woman coming through made it easier for the women coming after. When Anna Bligh became Premier after the resignation of Peter Beattie in September 2007, 36% of Queenslanders thought she would make a better Premier than her predecessor. Polls also showed that Labor enjoyed a two-party preferred vote of 57% compared to their opposition's vote of 43%. Labor had been in power for 9 years, and this was not the usual scenario for a woman in Australia taking over a leadership position. Usually, as former Victorian Premier Joan Kerner can attest, women are given the reins of power as the last option when faced with a virtually unwinnable election scenario. Peter Beattie, therefore, can also take some credit for the seamless transition to power of Anna Bligh. Bligh's approval rating as Premier reached a peak of 64% at the beginning of 2008, but Labor had been in power for a decade. As the year went on, there was a palpable mood that a fifth term for Labor was undesirable. South East Queensland's dams were at record low levels. Its hospital system seemed to be falling apart. The world economic recession were storm clouds on the horizon. A succession of Labor ministers were involved in criminal misdemeanors. Bligh's predecessors, Wayne Goss and Peter Beattie, changed Queensland in a thousand ways in their first years of office. Beyond the Fitzgerald reforms, and in the cold, hard light of day, Labor's term of government were unimpressive. Bligh's political career itself was a model of political managerialism. She once pointed to Western Australian Premier Carmen Lawrence's observation that, quote, as long as women are a minority, then they'll be a lightning rod for attention, end of quote. Bligh went on, I was very conscious of having to think carefully about what I say, who I say it to, when I say it, and what I'm wearing when I say it. If you want to be taken seriously, you have to take the steps necessary for people to see past you. In other words, don't put yourself between the camera and your ideas, end of quote. Bligh's term as Minister for Families, Youth, Community Care and Disabilities was disappointing because Queensland was so far behind comparable state standards and nothing much changed. There was no risk-taking, no big picture solutions, only an apprehension about the fact that any family crisis in the state had the potential to do political damage. As such, a giant bureaucratic bunker surrounded the minister and it was impossible to penetrate it. As Minister for Education and the Arts, Bligh added another year to Queensland schooling, bringing it into line with other states, but there was no vision. For decades, Queensland education had been far behind the rest of the Australian states. There was no passion for getting new high-quality teachers into schools. There was no concept of a more entrepreneurial school culture pursuing excellence for Indigenous students. In fact, the poor curriculum and chronic shortage of post-primary school options virtually condemned Indigenous young people, to use one example, to a second-rate education, and remains to this day. As Treasurer and Minister for Infrastructure, Bligh presided over a $14 billion infrastructure program and a very healthy employment and economic performance. But how much can a government really claim credit for this in a boom state like Queensland, with an abundance of resources, tourist attraction, climate advantages and environmental riches? Was it the government that created these positives, or was it in fact in the way a lot of the time? I remember during Bligh's period as Treasurer and Minister for Infrastructure, catching a train from Brisbane Airport into the CBD. The train was late by a long stretch. When I eventually got into the train, its automatic internal public communication system announced that I was heading to the Sunshine Coast, about 200 kilometres in the opposite direction. Unnervingly, at each stop, it announced a completely wrong destination. I remember thinking at the time, welcome to the so-called smart state, where spin is everything and bears absolutely no relation to what is going on in the real world. Of course, in this period, Queensland's capital city of Brisbane did undergo a renaissance. Brisbane City Council has a unique administration. Its budget is bigger than the state of Tasmania. Its area covers 1,400 square miles, and it's one of the biggest single city municipalities in the world. But the real hero and civic entrepreneur here was the Lord Mayor of Brisbane, Jim Sirley, from 1991 to 2003. Against all expectations, Sirley achieved an extraordinary victory, knocking off popular conservative incumbent Sally Ann Atkinson. Sirley's a bit of a controversial figure amongst Labor people, but in my view, he used the great economy of scale of Brisbane City to achieve thousands of practical things that made a difference, most spectacularly investing in the Brisbane River, setting up ferries to transport commuters to and from work, starting a river festival and a walkway around the river that created a dramatic transformation of city dwellers' day-to-day lives. Brisbane became a cosmopolitan city, seemingly overnight. But there was no love lost between Sirley and the state Labor governments. They were a contrast in style and substance, and more's the pity. Anna had done her apprenticeship, but she had not effected profound changes that would make Queenslanders sit up and take notice. She was a competent political manager. She surrounded herself with political managers who would protect her, but would also not let critical information in. Anne Warner had schooled her well that there would be no cracks for her internal and external enemies to expose and lever. But there was also no indication that Bligh would be someone who would rise up to great heights of leadership, no indication that she was someone who could really take Queensland into a new era of prosperity, cultural advancement, sophistication and confidence.